Here he is with 9 stone 12, 136 pounds as a four-year-old in the Melbourne Cup of 1930. 10,000 pounds sterling that race was worth, and the best stayers in Australia were engaged, but Firelap simply played with them. Aye, it's like he's taking candy from a baby. Firelap wins.
He's a phenomenal galloper. I think the best horse I've ever seen and ever rode.
The Red Terror, the greatest horse in the world.
In 1930, Firelap won 11 races in 11 weeks. Nothing compares with that.
We're going to lose you, and we're going to miss you. Good luck, Firelap. Australia's with you.
Going to America, Firelap was sent into the most treacherous racing environment that has ever existed.
But Firelap's got it. Come on, Firelap. Firelap, you beauty.
And then, at the height of his racing career, Firelap suddenly dies.
The Yanks killed him.
I rang Dad and said, oh, I'm going to Canberra. I said, I'll have a look at Firelap's heart while I'm there. And that's when he said, well, that'll be clever because it's not Firelap's heart, it's draft horses. Well, I just said to him, are you joking?
All the evidence is right there in front of us, in plain sight. I'm Kerry Negara, and this is Killing Firelap, a forensic investigation. Episode 6, Atherton, Menlo Park and San Mateo Peninsula, Horse Heaven, Gangster Heaven. Compared to the dust, tension, crime and poverty of Mexico, for Tommy, Menlo Park was a breath of fresh air, with native live oak trees and even eucalyptus trees bordering rolling pastures. It was a horse trainer's heaven. Yet the bright sunny pastures of Menlo Park, dotted with contented grazing horses, and the picturesque waters of the San Mateo Peninsula masked a different reality. As comfortable as the Perry stables are, the San Mateo County is full of crooked dealings that involve people of the lowest and highest ranks. Corruption and fraudulent transactions are making unimaginable personal fortunes during the worst economic depression ever known. Surrounded by this massive criminal activity, Firelap is seemingly secluded and safe at Menlo Park. His rear hoof is growing out, healing well, and Tommy is enjoying showing his champion horse to the many well-wishers who come to visit Firelap each afternoon. On Monday 4 April, there are as many as 1,000 visitors at the ranch to see Firelap, who is in fine form, showing off his tricks to the crowd. Behind the scenes, though, the serious punters and bookies are increasingly disgruntled. Still smarting from their losses on Firelap at Aguacaliente, they fear further losses and a lack of control over the racing gambling scene. It is pretty clear that Firelap is unbeatable and that his owners will not be bought off to manipulate his races. Every day, the sports and newspapers are full of Firelap's planned racing campaign. It is this planned campaign that spooks the mob-controlled books and those who would oppose him in the rich Eastern States races. Then, everything went wrong. Amidst the aftermath and shock straight after Firelap's death, Bill Nielsen found time to phone Bert Wolfe again, giving the journalist several fictitious details around the circumstances of the grisly death. Less than 2 hours after Firelap died, Bert Wolfe sent a report to the Melbourne Herald where the story of Firelap's death was published that day. Astonishing autopsy details were given to Bert Wolfe by Bill Nielsen that were a complete fabrication. The Herald reports that Mr. Nielsen believed alfalfa or barley covered with morning dew in the stable yard had been eaten by Firelap and had caused poisoning because it was not properly prepared. And an even unworse truth that Mr. Nielsen called in other veterinary surgeons who worked hard but were unable to overcome the impaction, which to those who don't know is a lodgment in the intestines. Even the New Zealand Timaru Herald on April 7, 1932, continued the falsehoods invented by Bill Nielsen. They report, the trainer T. Woodcock, who slept soundly only a few feet away from the thoroughbred, entered the horse's stall upon awakening this morning. The animal was lying down and frightened. Woodcock summoned Mr. Nielsen, who had no difficulty in diagnosing the ailment. The veterinary then plunged into the task of relieving the animal. With other veterinary assistants, he worked on his charge all the morning and into the afternoon. He bowed his head when Farlap drew his last breath. The fact is, no other vets were called, and Bill Nelson did no such diagnosis. Tommy Woodcock coped alone while Farlap died his excruciating death. Bill Nelson and Dr. Massaro were not present when Farlap died, arriving over an hour afterwards. There was no impaction of Farlap's intestines or intestinal obstruction, as Dr. Massaro correctly reported in his signed statement to Dave Davis and Harry Telford, and Farlap was not grazed on alfalfa or barley. So, where was the vet Bill Nelson when Farlap was struggling for life? Why did he not simply phone Dr. Massaro from the Menlo Park house? Why did it take him more than 3 hours to pick up Dr. Massaro, who was just 40 minutes away at most? Some 30 years later in the 1960s, Bill Nelson admitted to Graham Pierce, one of his vet students he'd become close to, that he lived with some guilt about Farlap's death, as he was not with the horse when he became sick, but rather was in town having a drink. When Tommy Woodcock was alone with Farlap in great pain, Bill Nelson was not fetching another vet. He was sitting in the bar of a speakeasy. The interview by ABC journalist Connor Duffy with Canberra vet Graham Pierce provides so much information about the duplicity of Bill Nelson.
With all the public interest in Farlap's death, why didn't Bill Nelson's versions of events come out sooner?
In many ways, he kept a low profile because he felt he should have been there earlier. He did feel responsible to some extent because he wasn't there, you see, when the horse fell ill. He'd have gone into town.
What did he go into town for?
Well, just to have a few drinks, I think, or to you know, socialise a bit.
Was it there in the bar that Bill Nelson invented the fictitious details of Farlap's death for racing journalist Bert Wolfe, who reported Nelson heroically attending to Farlap with the other vets he had called in, attempting in vain to save Farlap from an intestinal impaction caused by grazing on poisonous morning dew alfalfa, all a concocted fantasy, as the initial autopsy reported, no intestinal impaction. What a story. Nelson invented yet another tale for the young vet, this time falsely claiming that Tommy Woodcock had grazed Farlap on arsenic-sprayed pastures, ultimately poisoning him. This account is yet another fabrication intended to put the blame firmly onto Tommy Woodcock. In fact, some trees infested with caterpillars had been sprayed at Menlo Park with a lead arsenic spray on 31 March, 5 days before Farlap died. But even as Ed Perry pointed out, his own horses grazed on the same pasture as Farlap, eating even more of it than Farlap did. Yet none of them were affected. Bill Nelson's story to the young vet Graham Pierce confirms that Bill Nelson knew Farlap had been poisoned with arsenic decades before the synchrotron tests scientifically confirmed this. The first autopsy, acute poisoning by some unknown substance. On Tuesday afternoon, within hours of the death, Bill Nelson and Dr. Massaro called Dave Davis and asked his permission to open Farlap's body and perform an initial autopsy. Not long after the two vets arrive at the ranch, the stable hands drag Farlap's dead body out from the stable and into the courtyard on a wooden sled. There they begin their grisly work, slicing open Farlap's stomach. What all present see unnerves them. Farlap's stomach and internal organs are red raw. They are confronted by the dreadful spectacle of his perforated and exploded stomach. The scene is raucous with raised, angry voices. Watched by Tommy Woodcock, Jack Martin and Billy Elliott, the autopsy revealed red raw stomach and intestines and a perforated stomach. Stuart Nixon, retired newspaper executive, attended Menlo School for Boys. He was 16 at the time.
We kids all loved Farlap, you know, from our dormitory windows on the second floor. We'd watch him on the exercise track, and they'd let us pet him. He was gentle and really, really intelligent. The day he died, several of us ran over after school, just as they were finishing the post-mortem. Men were shouting and cursing and weeping all at the same time. It was just a terrible scene. Someone in the crowd said the exercise boy had let the horse graze on wet grass.
Tommy Woodcock stood over Farlap's carcass and, looking at the perforated stomach lining, says, "That's not colic." The two vets in this public environment have no choice but to agree death by poisoning, albeit substance unknown. Dr. Massero writes in his report to Farlap's owners that he found severe inflammation in the stomach and colon, no internal obstruction. "I believe the horse died through some poison substance in the stomach. An ordinary case of colic could not have killed the horse in such a short time." Bill Nielsen's signed statement concurred with Dr. Massero, reporting,
"An acute inflammatory condition of the whole abdominal cavity. The lining of the stomach badly perforated as if from some irritant poison. The signs were of acute gastric enteritis brought about by some toxic substance unknown."
Bill Nielsen's statement to Harry Telford also reports that,
"At noon, his temperature had increased to 102 and the animal showed signs of extreme distress. At this time, I diagnosed the condition as one of acute poisoning and I hurried to the car to obtain the services of Dr. Massero."
The two vet statements were given to Dave Davis and sent to Harry Telford in Australia. This original autopsy, where the men stand over Farlap's carcass, confronted by the dreadful spectacle of his perforated, exploded stomach, produced the most honest description and interpretation of what had happened to Farlap. Death by poison substance in the stomach. Yet this honest depiction is overturned the following week and will swerve vicariously to become more simply death by colic. How did a case of poisoning become diagnosed as colic in one short week? Many of the answers can be found in Bill Nielsen's scheming. Why did Bill Nielsen omit from his post-mortem report the critical information that he had medicated Farlap in the early morning? Why did he not report what he had medicated Farlap with? And where was Dave Davis when Farlap died? No prizes for guessing. Typically on the money trail, once again, Dave could be found in the office of Louis B. Mayer at MGM Studios in Hollywood, negotiating a lucrative contract for Farlap's film appearances. Given the dreadful news, Davis immediately returns to his home in San Francisco, arriving the following day. Did Ed Perry recruit Bill Nielsen into this death plan? Whether the two men happily take the money to carry out this dreadful act or not, are their lives possibly at risk if they don't carry through? Easily at hand, as demonstrated by his wife Suzanne's accusations, arsenic was Ed Perry's poison of choice. Post-mortem, missing organs. Straight away, Bill Nielsen removed, mounted and preserved Farlap's heart and shipped it to Australia to Dr. Stuart McKay, a Sydney doctor who was a Farlap enthusiast. But what was the hurry? Then on 7 April, 2 days after Farlap's death, Bill Nielsen removed the remaining organs that were now in a semi-putrefied state. Having isolated a few samples for the post-mortem, he sent these to the Hooper Foundation at the University of California in San Francisco, unrefrigerated. Bill Nielsen had taken the remaining organs, which formed the bulk of Farlap's insides, put them in a metal box, and with the other Australians sadly watching, buried them on a rise overlooking the Menlo Park stables. Dave Davis made a statement to the press.
"I cannot conceive of a fiend who might have been vicious enough to poison Farlap, but I have never heard of a horse dying from colic in such a way as Farlap did, and I believe I owe it to every racing man to make a thorough investigation."
In effect, Bill Nielsen shipped away and then buried the most vital organs of the autopsy evidence. Why did he do this? Dr. Carl Meyer was furious when presented with the rank bits and pieces of Farlap's putrefied organs. How could he perform a professional autopsy with any credibility for the outcome? Nevertheless, he tried his best, yet announced his findings as inconclusive because of the scarcity of organ material provided. Dave had employed Dr. Carl Meyer, the respected director of the George Williams Hooper Foundation at the University of California, to head up the autopsy. Dr. Meyer was charged with personally examining Farlap's organs and arranging for toxicology examinations. Dr. Meyer was a hero amongst his medical science peers, being hailed as the Pasteur of the 20th century. He was an exceptional scientist in the field of infectious diseases in man and animals. He developed a vaccine for the deadly yellow fever and increased our knowledge of brucellosis, equine encephalitis, and animal bacteriology. On 9 April 1932, the morning of the official autopsy, Dr. Meyer was a man on a mission. Publicly, he had promised he would conduct the investigation of his career. He maintained he would clear the people of California from any wrongdoings with the champion horse. But when Dr. Meyer entered the post-mortem room, his mood quickly changed when confronted by the scant, decomposing samples of liver, spleen, stomach, and intestine. Dr. Meyer was annoyed. Where was the heart? Where was the complete stomach of the horse? Where was the large colon? He declared the material delivered to him to be utterly inadequate. How could he conduct the investigation of his life with most of the organs missing? However, he did the best he could in the limiting circumstances and delivered his findings. But he also reported that the autopsy was inconclusive because of the lack of organs to study. The farcical autopsy. I am reminded again that to hide something means to leave behind traces. In reviewing the written reports of Farlap's post-mortem and autopsy, there are omissions, inconsistencies, and outright contradictions. The reports, actions, and motivations of the characters involved reveal a story of hidden evidence, vested interests, and deception. Bill Nielsen buries most of Farlap's remains in a metal box near Menlo Park. In an extraordinary move, he fails to deliver these vital organs to Farlap's autopsy. The heart, the large colon, and most of the stomach are missing from the autopsy. Most notably, he fails to mention the medicine he gave to Farlap in the early morning. A huge red flag is raised for this significant omission. Despite the missing organs, contradictory evidence, and shifting opinions, the autopsy findings nevertheless resulted in concluding that
the death of the racehorse Farlap was caused by a colicky condition manifesting itself in the form of an acute inflammation of the stomach and the intestines. The factors responsible for the acute inflammation have not been determined.
And here is the key.
And probably never will be determined on account of the incompleteness of the clinical data and post-mortem findings. To date, lead arsenate, which was found in very small quantities in the body of the horse and in the feet, may be responsible for the irritation of the intestinal tract.
Dr. Meyer forms the private opinion that there is a desire to suppress some of the evidence, which might possibly show poor supervision of Farlap. However, his assignment is to reconstruct the cause of death, not to act as a detective. And according to Australian journalist Isabel Carter, he does not probe for reasons why such meagre post-mortem samples have been submitted. I asked librarian Chris Burns in San Francisco to take a look at the archive of Dr. Meyer. What Chris turned up was gratifying. Writing in a letter to his father at the time, Dr. Meyer explains,
I'm being dragged into the case.
And
one must be careful as these things are very political.
Suggesting his concern over the impact of his findings, it appears he fully realises that death by colic is a less provocative finding for such a public death. Yet Dr. Meyer also puts it firmly on the public record that he frankly declares his autopsy findings inconclusive due to the inadequate material provided to him. The US Food and Drug Administration find traces of lead arsenate in pasture and leaf samples on the Perry Ranch. They also find traces of lead arsenic and arsenic trioxide in samples of Farlap's organs. Most importantly, within a week, opinions on what caused Farlap's death shift dramatically from poisoning to mere colic. These shambolic events are covertly orchestrated by Bill Nielsen, putting out stories of Farlap being grazed on poisonous pastures and mounting and burying the main organs instead of presenting them at the post-mortem. But what on earth can we make of Bill Nielsen sitting drinking for over 2 hours in a speakeasy bar and failing to phone the local vet Dr. Macero while Farlap died his excruciating death? No one thought to question any of this at the time, or indeed at any time. And then everyone went back to work. Enduring a terrible grief in the days after Farlap died, Tommy Woodcock received a call from a horse trainer, Harry Una, who he had met at Caliente. Harry convinced Tommy to come down to his home and stables in San Diego for a short stay to get away from the sad environment at Menlo Park. Tommy enjoyed his stay and was grateful to Harry for his care and concern.
When I was in Tijuana, I met a nice old man he trained horses, a man called Harry Una. And after the horse died, he came up right up to see me. He said, come on, son. He said, come and spend a couple of days with me down at San Diego. He had a beautiful home down there. He had a big jetty out the back and it was really nice. I stopped a few days with him.
Immediately after Farlap's death, Tommy is offered a job by wealthy East Coast racehorse and stud owner Wallace Sharp Kilmer to join his racing team in Chicago. The rest of the Australian crew are also offered jobs with the Kilmer team. Tommy takes on two young horses who are said to be damaged and too wild, Sun Mealless and Sun Archer. Working his magic on these two supposedly impossible horses, in the following months, Tommy gently forges these talented young sprinters into winners for Wallace Kilmer. Tommy's wife Emma sails out from Australia to join Tommy, and together they are doing well in the United States. And then, quite out of the blue, while Tommy is training for Wallace in Chicago in the weeks following Farlap's death, he bumps into Harry Una from San Diego yet again. In a seemingly coincidental reunion, Harry tells Tommy that a good friend of his wants to meet him.
I start to train there down in Chicago. And who's to come along was Harry Una. And I was pleased to see him. And he said, how you going? I showed him the horses and he said, they look well, don't they? I said, yes. I said, well, little bay horse had gone well too, they fell with the bad knees. He said, I'll take you to meet a friend of mine.
Harry's friend is none other than Al Capone.
We had a good old talk and one thing and another, you know, about Australia, about the racing over here. You know, we spent a little bit of time there.
The timing of this meeting is when Al Capone is waiting for the outcome of his tax fraud trial. Al paid for a soft, comfortable lifestyle, whether in or out of jail. Tommy met him on one of these soft occasions. Al Capone, in reality, was not a nice man. He was a psychopath, responsible for brutal violence and mass killings of hundreds of people. And typically for the psychopath, he had a split personality, a real charmer out in public and at the track, flinging coins and tips to the needy, a seemingly devoted husband and family man who brought home venereal diseases from prostitutes and had several mistresses. Not unusual for Al to be ordering a hit on someone before dinner. How on earth did Harry Una know someone like Al Capone? What was the San Diego horse trainer doing to have such a close connection with this top mob boss? Was there more to the seemingly accidental meeting between Tommy and Harry Una at Agua Caliente and then in Chicago? Of Harry's insistence that Tommy rest at his San Diego ranch after Farlap's death? The relationship between Harry Una and Al Capone is most probably one of a trainer-owner front to Al's underground ownership of racehorses. It is definitely a very lucrative friendship for Harry Una, who lives in high style at his horse ranch. Harry bringing Tommy to meet his gangster friend is yet another curious part of the Farlap story. Curious, but as Christian Cipollini would say, not coincidental when it comes to the mob's activities.
I have yet to see a coincidence in any of it. And I know that's pretty black and white statement, but nothing is a coincidence in organized crime.
While enjoying training success for Wallace Kilmer, suddenly, Tommy's visa is declared invalid. He is visited by a US immigration official who informs him that he is working illegally in the United States. Tommy always told us that he suspected Dave Davis was crooked on him for declining to further train for him in America and had reported him to the officials. I have a letter to Tommy from Wallace Kilmer offering to support Tommy's visa. Kilmer did not want to lose his talented trainer, but Tommy and Emma have already made up their mind to return to Australia. They have a brief holiday road tripping to the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone National Park, sailing home in August 1932 on the same steamer, the Monowai, that had brought Tommy and Farlap to the US on their fateful journey. Bill Nielsen and Billy Elliot stay on for a short time. Jack Cashy Martin and Billy Elliot both die young, Cashy from pneumonia and Billy in a racing accident. We found Suzanne Perry's will, where she confirms Ed Perry's dubious nature. She directs her executor to pay $200 to my husband, Edward T. Perry, each month during the administration of my estate. This sum is for his living expenses and is not to be used for luxuries and gambling. And if the money is used for such, I direct my executor to refuse the payment of same until it is shown that said sums are used for necessities. My husband has received during my lifetime considerable sums of money and has spent the money foolishly. When the Australian party return home, Bill Nielsen quietly disappears from the racing scene. He teaches vet students and lives unobtrusively near Australia's east coast. He does no interviews and is never heard from publicly again. Bill Nielsen slipped away, having succeeded in planting the seeds of Tommy Woodcock's grand blunder. His fabrications successfully live on. When the subject comes up, people often ask me, did Tommy Woodcock accidentally poison Farlap? Dave Davis remains in San Francisco, dabbling in horses. He even brings Farlap's brother out to the States, with no success. Davis does not return to Australia. Harry Telford keeps trying to breed another Farlap, but is woefully unsuccessful and sends himself and his family bankrupt. Having lost everything, separated from his much-suffering family, Harry even hocks his Melbourne Cup trophy, sadly dying alone on Sol Green's property at Bacchus Marsh. Several of Farlap's body parts are spread over Australasia. His skeleton goes to the Dominion Museum in Wellington, near his birthplace in New Zealand. His formaldehyde-preserved heart is given to the Institute of Anatomy in Canberra, and his skillfully mounted hide forms an effigy which stands in the Melbourne Museum. The remaining organ parts are still buried in a metal box somewhere on a residential estate in Atherton, San Francisco, on what was once an adjoining Perry property, overlooking Menlo Park Ranch. The metal box has never been found. Yet, does this matter? Decades later, science will give us the clues we need. History will meet science to reveal the amazing technology that, like a time machine, travels to 1932, to the fateful day that Farlap died. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Farlap, a forensic investigation. Technical producer is Richard Di Gregorio.
Hi, Richard here. We'll be putting up two episodes every week of Kerry's amazing investigation, Killing Farlap. There are 9 episodes in all, so make sure you subscribe and the episodes will automatically come into your podcast library. We welcome any feedback and comments and hope if you enjoy the podcast, you will give us a star rating and review. Thanks for listening.